Hello, and welcome to Hard Fried History, a hybrid history
and comedy
podcast run by two aspiring entertainers.
Podcast, it's more of a rant, really.
That have failed at almost everything else.
I don't fail because I don't try, so there.
We appreciate you checking us out, and if you want to see extra content, follow us on Instagram or give us a like on Facebook at Hard Fried History.
Subscribe to us on YouTube or tell us we're full of shit on Twitter at HFH Podcast.
Feel like going that extra mile? Give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. Or wherever you're listening, and leave us a flattering, a glowing review.
And of course, tell your friends, family, and even people you don't like about us.
That's right. Again, thank you for listening, and without further ado, the episode.
How are you doing today?
Oh, you know me, man. I am exuberant. I am
okay.
Overflowing with an abundance of joy. Everything is going well in my life. I'm okay. Gradually accepting that, like, envy is futile because everyone is miserable, you know?
I've never said this to another person. Yo, have you ever fucking tried yoga? Like... this is stress. You need to take some stress out of life. And I think the only way you can do it is through stretching.
Maybe. You know, I have had a lot of tension in my shoulders lately, and it's supposed to. How are you doing? How are you doing, Josh?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm ready to get to the podcast.
Well, you know who's not good.
Okay. All right. What are you doing?
Nothing. Okay. So this is our 100th episode. So that's cool. Hooray us.
Wow.
Clap in your car if if you're there. Clap for us and we'll feel the love, right? Okay. And again, sincerely, if you've listened once, if you listen for 10 seconds and you were like, fuck these guys, and if you've listened to every single episode that we've ever released and are still with us, thank you no matter what side of the spectrum you're on or if you're a casual listener and in between, whatever. Thanks, sincerely. I know it doesn't sound. I know I can't take the snideness out of my voice.
How about you just say, "Hey, I love you."
I
love you guys. Mm-hmm. Okay, and gals. It does skew. There's a lot of guys.
Yes, it does.
Good amount of girls. Good amount of women. Good amount of women. I love y'all, and non-binary.
Y'all, exactly. Y'all. Ambiguous, all in vague, inclusivity, right?
There we go. So for the 100th episode, what are we doing here?
We're doing, in light of recent events, we were going to do something special, but I figured instead let's focus on something relevant, something that's going on, something that it would help to have context on, and that would be Afghanistan within the last 40 years. We're doing some episodes later on... like Osama bin Laden and Exxon and the Middle East generally. And I had already done some reading on.
Yeah.
And I had just had this information and I figured let's do this. So it will be a 10-year history. Unfortunately, we will not talk like that much about the Taliban, but we will study the Soviet occupation and the 10-year history and the nature of U.S. support and the Mujahideen and all this stuff.
But we're going to come back around. Mm-hmm. To Afghanistan and the Taliban at a later time when we talk about Osama. Well, all right.
Let's talk about this. This is basically a prelude for the next 5 weeks or so.
Yeah.
But without further ado, from January of 1978 to February of 1979, so 13 months, this is approximately the time span of the Iranian Revolution and the overthrow of Shah Reza Pahlavi. It's basically like a Western puppet dictator. And there's a kind of a more broadly than Iran, there's a reverberations throughout the Middle East. There's more or less a Islamic awakening and like a reaction to the secular and Western dominance in the Middle East. And again, there's shockwaves throughout the region, and that there's this almost this third way of life. Because if you look at the history of the Middle East through the lens of the Cold Wars, that you do have some like Arabic people who are deciding like, we will be secular and maybe we'll adopt democracy. And then others who are like, no, we'll be secular, but we'll adopt communism. We'll be socialist. And so those are those two groups. And then behind this kind of, you know, emerging and rumbling throughout is like, no, we have had our own way of life and our own way of conducting business and conducting a political entity and conducting society generally. We've had that for a while, you know, 1200 years or so. 1400 years,
I would argue. Well, yeah, if you're gonna talk,
let's
about
do that, right? This Islamic third context. Way, this third option, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's some people when they talk about like the third, like the option of like kind of, we're talking about like radicalism, like what are, we're talking about like kind of Islamic militancy. Is that what we're talking about?
Not entirely, because there are splits in every faction. You know, is that there could be like, hey, like, not, I don't want to say light Sharia because it gets a reputation, but you do have your hardcore elements that do emerge. But I'm sure there's also sort of Islamic moderates who are just like, there's a way to make it work. I'm sure there's like Islamic intellectuals who have written, you know, their PhD papers on how this is feasible.
Sure. There are a lot. Yeah. All right.
And then again, I forgot to mention, but the source that we're going off of is Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden from the Soviet Invasion to September 10th, 2001 by Steve Cole, published in 2004. But anyway, in 1978... So while the Iranian Revolution is going on, there's another coup in Afghanistan that installs the Democratic Republic of Afghanistan, or DRA, and it is ruled by the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan, or PDPA. Yeah. It is nominally socialist, has a central committee, and it's divided between kind of these two main factions. You have the Khalkist faction, which is a little more radical, or kind of made up of the lower classes, and they're in favor of a more immediate establishment of a communist regime. Something I like to refer to like the gotta crack a few eggs school, you know. And then there's the Parcham faction, which is more like upper class. Some of them have some ties to the Afghan royal family. They're in favor of a more gradual shift to communism, seeing as Afghanistan needed to develop and kind of lacked infrastructure. And so maybe let's not just raw dog communism, because some bad things happen if you try to do that. I mean, sometimes.
Yeah.
It's happened before.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. And then people will answer you, be like, look, the backslide. We don't want to go. We don't want to end up in a weird middle.
Yep.
With just the infrastructure, but no, like, socialism. It's just like, look, man, I don't want to be in charge.
I'm going to get out of here. You know, see where this is going. So the top or the three main dudes that I want to focus on, the three key players, I believe, are Nur Muhammad Taraki, who is of the Khalk faction, Hafizullah Amin, who is his protege, and then Babrak Karmal is a member of the Parcham faction. They three together sort of unleash this, like, something called the Red Terror, which there have been a bunch of Red Terrors in a bunch of different communist regimes. There's a lot of Red Terrors. Like, which Red Terror are you talking about? There's a lot that happened. Dude.
It's always funny when they talk about like people in Europe watching the American like elections, because over there, like in America, it's red is the Republicans and the right, and then blue is like the left and the Democrats, you know, nominally. And this is like just saying like it's a complete opposite is always very interesting to me.
Yeah, red terror. Do you mean Kerry?
Okay.
Have you seen Kerry? Right? That's the only Red Terror I know about, like, right? You know, in Maine.
I feel like I didn't have a good story, and then you followed it up with an even worse story.
That was a comment. Anyway. March of 1779, there's a populist uprising in the Afghan city of Herat. which is mostly, I don't want to say mostly, but it is partly a reaction to the arrests and the assassinations undertaken by the government, the Red Terror, partly due to the failure of agrarian reforms, and then partly a fundamentalist reaction to secularism and religious crackdowns. Like, there had been some, like, ulama, which are members of, like, the Islamic high society or just Islamic intellectuals who are really versed in the Quran. They had been, like, oppressed in some way, arrested. It's known as the Herat Uprising, and one of the people closely associated with it is this guy, Ismail Khan, who's an army captain. The Herat Division, I believe, because it starts off with just civilians and demonstrators, and then the army is called in to put it down, but they end up siding with the demonstrators, and Ismail Khan is just there handing out weapons, just army weapons, to civilians. It's busting it open, you know?
Okay.
Taraki, Nur Muhammad Taraki, he is asking for Soviet assistance from Yuri Andropov of the KGB, and he's talking, Alexei Kosygin, who's like a high-ranking member of the Politburo, who I think was a contemporary of Khrushchev as well, is talking with Andropov, is talking with other members of the Politburo, and there's this emerging consensus among them that Taraki and Hafizullah Amin are in trouble. They face potentially thousands of insurgents. The USSR, it can't lose Afghanistan, because that would kind of contradict the Brezhnev doctrine, and if there's one nominally socialist state that kind of breaks off from the orbit of the USSR, how's that going to look for all of these other republics that we've got under our yoke, right? But also, the Politburo does not trust Taraki and Amin. They get the sense that they're like hiding some things and not giving them the full story about what's going on in Afghanistan. So it's like, we need to hold on to the province, but we don't like the leadership.
Yeah, so basically, they're looking at it, and like, Taraki is looking at it. He's just like, fuck, I have to rely on the Soviets. The Soviets are looking at it like, oh man, they can also become part of this weird third way thing with the like China kind of like third way of like non-aligned countries, or they can become an American like satellite country.
Yeah.
And this Afghanistan is like very strategically important, not because it has any, well, because of the minerals now.
Yeah.
And like mining rights, but like it's very important because of what it borders.
Yeah.
It's not really like it's the border. You have a border to Iran, you have a border to Pakistan, you have all the stands, board, like I think it's Tajikistan boards. And like you have this weird perch where you can just see everything.
Yep.
And touch everything, which is interesting.
Yeah. And it's also a ripe pipeline country. That's kind of what makes it ripe pipeline country. So
true.
What the USSR ends up doing is they do have some Soviet technicians that actually die in the Herat Uprising, so they do have to respond. So they sell some equipment to the Afghanistan government, Taraki and Amin, and they do deploy more advisors to the region. Meanwhile, in the States, the CIA is handing memos to President Jimmy Carter asking if he would support these rebels. And Carter himself, he's sort of... America generally, and the CIA in particular, is operating in the wake of the Church Committee proceedings, where the American public has just basically been told a few choice skeletons from the CIA's closet have been pulled out before the public, and the public's basically saying, you know, this is crazy. Somebody should do something about this, right? This is nuts. So they can't just go in there and, you know, do what they've been doing for about three decades now in other countries, which is just kicking down the door and blowing somebody's skull out of their heads. But, you know, they got to do something, right? Maybe. And then Carter's also working on the hostage crisis and, you know.
This is like, and these are the kind of the environment that Charlie Wilson's war type
We'll get there. Yeah. But basically, comparatively to some other things that we've talked about on this podcast, their hands are tied. They can't do what they'd like to.
No, you can't. Yeah, we just went through Vietnam and then all of the stuff that's coming out about just inside the country, everybody's getting real tight.
Yeah,
but they're gonna find a way. Mm-hmm. Look, we could talk about
teamwork makes the dream
a lot
work.
Of things.
Okay, there's this other key player, Zia-ul-Haq, who is the president of Pakistan, and he's not exactly an ally to the U.S., but he was willing to allow us to build satellite stations in Pakistan since the U.S. had just lost their Iranian stations, and they need to be able to eavesdrop, basically.
I know you did India, so like, what's India's relationship right during this time? And like, in terms of like India's backstage, I mean, if you remember, dude, yeah, that's
there. I feel like
because they're both playing. Pakistan's like playing, trying to play like both sides. From my understanding, is that Pakistan's the more stable one.
They've still got India's their eye on Kashmir, and then this is also, and I've wondered about this, but the guy or the event that ended up taking down Indira Gandhi. Was the Khalistan, I think, was the name of it, and Bindrawale and his like separatist movement. But he was Muslim, and that was kind of his whole thing. And I don't know if Pakistan was like encouraging that, but I also know that they have their eye on Kashmir, which, you know, is nominally Indian territory. They both have that claim to Kashmir. And Ul Haq had just killed Zulfikar Ali Bhutto. And I don't know. I think Bhutto was more amenable to the U.S. and he was, like, friendlier. And then Zia Ul Haq is like, I'm going to do something else, you know?
It's a, yeah. Okay. Yeah, no, this is, we've lost so many listeners who would have
no idea. Yeah, who had no idea what any of this stuff means.
Yeah. But, yeah, go watch it. Go watch the Indira Gandhi episodes.
Yep. Go listen to them. Get caught up, you know?
Get caught up.
So, in July of 1979, Taraki and Amin begin a purge of all the Parchamist elements. And so, Babrak Karmal, he goes into hiding because he's a Parchamist, and he's eventually evacuated by Soviet forces and given residency in Czechoslovakia for a time. They're all trying to figure out what to do because too much blood is being spilled in Afghanistan. You have all of these people who are upset at the government, and the government's like, we don't care. They got to crack a few eggs. They're thinking this is what Russia did. And whenever it came to power, is it just purged all of these dangerous elements, and that's what led to their eventual stability, you know.
So this is, I mean, the okay. so they're cracking down, trying to get rid of all the oppositional factors,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this is the problem when you do that, especially like specifically, in the Middle East. The problem when you do that is people have to push their frustration some way, and one of the like firm parts of, you know, life in the Middle East, Islam, mm-hmm. And they start pushing it through that, so then it starts. Then they're pushing frustrations through, and then they can find some more radical elements, but, you know, through that way. Because they're giving them any other option.
No.
There's no political option.
And you're just kind of like killing people in mass, and that's bound to make more enemies than it, you know? You kind of just need to address the needs of the people. You shouldn't just I'm just going to kill anybody who's hungry, you know?
Yeah.
It's not that's a feasible not solution, you
know? That's never good.
So what Karmal is doing from Czechoslovakia is he's still talking to other Parchamist elements in Afghanistan. They start actually planning a coup against Hafizullah Amin. And the Khalkhis, again, what it came down to is I thought like, well, the Khalkhis are more in favor of like communism now. And so why wouldn't the Soviet Union want them? Why do they want the Parchamists who are like upper class and have ties to the royal family and are more in favor of like a gradual move toward communism? And it's like, well, everybody hates the Khalkhists. It doesn't really matter if they're more ideologically pure and if they're more in line with what would be the ideal for Russia if everybody wants them out of power. Maybe you do, like, it's, you know, it's better to have something than nothing. And if the Parchamists are like, hey, we're still socialists, but we'll do it in a way that's still kind of rooted in a more longstanding Afghani institution, then maybe people are going to be, you know, if they will accept something moderate, they won't topple the radical. They won't topple this thing that we have and just poison the entire well.
Okay. I mean, look, it sounds reasonable.
Sounds reasonable enough, right? Yeah, it's like, this guy's more amenable. He's not as radical, but But people aren't as upset at this faction, yeah. it seems. Yeah. You know, yeah. so let's yeah. work with what we got, right?
Yeah.
And there are more armed forces mutinies kind of across Afghanistan throughout 17. I'm sorry, I keep on going 17. 1979. And September of 1979, you have the murder of Nur Muhammad Taraki by Hafizullah Amin. So there's like a split in the inside the Calchist faction itself. Okay. Neither side, that being the US and the USSR, is really sure about Amin. The KGB thinks that he could be like a CIA agent or this could be a CIA plot, but this claim yeah. hasn't really been substantiated. And then, boom, December of 1979, Hafizullah Amin is killed in Operation Storm-333, which is the official beginning of the Soviet occupation. Babrak Karmal is installed as chairman of the Revolutionary Council, and he's the leader of Afghanistan, and he takes it right the other way and begins a purge of the Calchist elements inside yeah. of Afghanistan.
Okay. So it's just like a civil war, basically.
But just just beginning a civil war, basically. You know, making it official. Only now Russia has taken a solid side in favor yeah. of one side, and they're propping their nation building, or they're trying yeah. to nation build. You know,
they're about to. What did Bush call it when he went in? You know,
I don't know.
Making the world safe for freedom.
World safe for freedom.
I don't know what he said. That it sucks. Was safe for democracy.
Something. That was Woodrow Wilson. And maybe he was like throwing back, you know.
And maybe he was doing something.
Or maybe if he was making the world safe for freedom, maybe he was trying to play off of what Woodrow Wilson said. But it just sounds kind of idiotic, you know.
I don't want to misquote Bush misquoting something.
Okay.
I don't want it to be the inception of misquoting.
So around this time as well, this is when the U.S. begins funneling weapons through to the Mujahideen and the Caucasus, and basically whoever the ISI. The ISI is the Inter-Services Intelligence. This is Pakistan's intelligence service. And so I'm not sure exactly, or I don't remember, or I don't know if it wasn't covered, if the CIA had a stipulation when they're passing off all of these weapons to Pakistan's intelligence service, the ISI, if they're saying, give these to these types of people, or if they're just deferring to Pakistan and saying, Pakistan, you know who to arm, whoever you want, just as long as they're fighting the Soviets, you know. The Mujahedin, I've also heard it, translates approximately into holy warriors.
Yeah.
So the ISI, again, Pakistan's intelligence service, would hand off the weapons and train Afghani fighters at madrasas on the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan. The CIA could train its own Pakistani instructors, so it's not entirely accurate to say that the CIA was training the Mujahideen. The CIA was training the guys who were training the Mujahideen. It's very exact, you know, to be precise, but, you know.
It's a step away.
For sure, yeah.
But let's not lie. Like, they don't know who those guns are going to. Yeah. They don't know who these weapons. They know who they're giving them to.
Yeah.
And, I mean, at this time, I don't know if there's been a lot of terrorist stuff going on. As far as, I think when Beirut happens, that's
4 years later.
4 years
that's
later.
That's 83, okay. So 83. It's not really, yeah. you know. I don't want to say there's been more stuff in Latin America, but there was like a plane that blew up in 76, I believe.
There has
like
been
tied
a lot.
To Cuba and stuff, you know.
There were a lot of, like, there's Lockerbie bombing and all that stuff. Yeah. So there's like, yeah, there's stuff going on. Mm-hmm. The terrorism is a thing, but I don't think it's not 9/11 like we know.
We're not
now.
There yet. Yeah, for sure. One of the main sites where, or one of the main cities where just a lot of this activity, this training is occurring and weapons are
One sec. In this country. It's not 9/11 in this country.
Yes.
There have been other terrorist attacks outside yes. the country. Yeah. It was crazy. All right.
One of the main cities associated with all this is Peshawar, because it's literally right on the border between Pakistan. It's in Pakistan, but Afghanistan is very close to Peshawar.
Yeah.
July of 1980, Prince Turki al-Faisal al-Saud, who's a member of the Saudi royal family, reaches an agreement with the CIA, agreeing to match their donations. The Saudi Intelligence Service is the General Intelligence Division, or GID, and these weapons, and Turki Al-Faisal, he built up the GID. Yeah. He doesn't run it anymore. It's one of his arms, Ahmed Badib, but, you know, he's still heavily involved in the day-to-day operations, although he's not, he doesn't, I don't know if he has an official position, but he built it, you know, so it's his baby, right? And these weapons are coming in from all over the world. Like, some of the places he mentioned are like Turkey, Greece, China's getting in on this a little bit, India, the U.S., Egypt, like, just, you have all of these arms and all of this money just flying around in Pakistan. And of course you have like some shady arms transactions going down, and you know, sometimes like a Pakistani arms manufacturer, like a private company, would sell weapons to the CIA, who would then give those weapons back to Pakistan, you know.
Yeah,
so, you know, there's money to be made, right?
Oh yeah. No, I mean, it becomes a booming economy.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, whenever. Yeah, I think somebody. I don't know if it, I think it might have been Peshawar. Vice, one of like their early videos was the visiting a gun market in Pakistan.
Wow.
And I think it was in Peshawar. It's just like a market you can go to, and it's fucking Soviet style weapons all over the fucking place. It's just still to this day, because, you know, there's a war to be fought. There's money to be made.
Yeah.
Off that war.
I like to picture just some big handlebarred mustache rootin' tootin' Texan.
Uh-huh.
Just sort of like, best gun market I ever been to over there in Peshawar, you know, brother. Yeah. Got some of the stuff. You can't even find that stuff anywhere anymore, man. But you can find it in Peshawar, brother.
Freedom.
You want any of them good restaurants to go to? I'll show you around, man. I'll have my fellas hook you up, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
The end of 1980, there's like 1.4 million Afghan refugees in Pakistan. To show you how bad the war is getting, the president of Pastan, Mohammad Zia-ul Haq, is increasingly wary of Soviet operations spreading into Pakistan as a result of the war and just the general destability or instability of the situation.
Yeah.
May of 1981, Howard Hart, he's a CIA operative running arms to the Mujahideen in Islamabad, Pakistan, just a name associated with it if you want to look into it. And the director of the GID, again, is this guy, Ahmed Badib. He is sent to Peshawar, to Islamabad as well around this time. And he's sent by Prince Turki Al-Faisal to funnel money through the ISI. So now you've got the CIA, the GID of Saudi Arabia, all giving money to the ISI, again, Pakistan's intelligence service, who are giving money to. So it's a coalition. You're building a coalition, basically. Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, the United States versus the Soviet Union.
And if, say you're a Mujahideen and you just got there and you're just a tall guy, and say you have some type of relations to your family, has very relation to the government of Saudi Arabia, that would help you to rise fast through the ranks of the Mujahideen and become and play a prominent role, because you can facilitate, because you already know the people that you need to know.
Yeah, and you also are also loaded.
Yeah.
Which never hurts. Not even from all of this hot international aid, just
the networking. I already know. We went to the same prep school, Doug.
Yeah, man.
Me and that minister's son went to the same prep school. Mm-hmm. We played squash together.
They play squash?
I don't know. I made that last part up, but the rest of it was
squash is fun, you know. Another big thing that plays into this is, as with everything, clientism, but it gets a little complex here. I'm just going to throw some names out there. Saudi Arabia's main guy in the region was this Pashtun warrior chief commando, Abdul Rasul Sayaf. And then Pakistan's main ally in the region is Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who's a Gilji Pashtun. Sorry.
Okay. All
right. And then
Pashtun's just like the ethnic group.
Yeah, I believe so. I think
Pashtun was a language, Doug. I am.
I think it's an ethnicity, and then tribes exist within that ethnicity, and Pashtuns speak, I believe, Pashto. But I would look that up.
Nobody's gonna ever question you on that.
I hope so. I hope not. You know, I hope they do. I hope they look it up. You know, we can look up anything right now.
It's, oh, we it's can one battle, of the, dog.
We can do it, right? At me. You know, let's do it. And then there's this other guy up in the north, 1981 to 1982. This man Ahmed Shah Massoud, who's a Tajik, whom speaks Farsi, I believe. They're holding down. Ahmed Shah Massoud and his men are holding down the Salang Highway. And the Salang Highway is the main transport road from Central Asia and moreover the Soviet Union, Russia, to Kabul, which is the capital of Afghanistan, where Karmal is set up and where Karmal needs his supplies delivered. But you've got this pesky Massoud and his guerrilla fighters who have basically shut down the Salang Highway, and they're using guerrilla tactics. Ahmed Shah Massoud himself, he's pretty versed in guerrilla warfare. He read Che Guevara, Regis Debray, and Mao Zedong as well, as far as inspiration. He knows where to get his ideas from, and he knows the land. He knows the territory, right?
He knows, yeah, man.
Helps.
Yeah, it's a pesky thing about Mao, dog. When you read him, it can be used against anybody.
Anybody, man. Ooh, he came to clap back from the Russians, you know, in a way you'd never anticipate.
From the grave, he's just clapping back.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Where in the world is Mao Zedong at this point? Is he dead at this point?
He's 81? Dead. He's dead now. Yeah.
Okay. He's in the ground at this point. Yeah, exactly. There you have it. Yeah. Yeah. Massoud is operating out of the Panjshir Valley, and he is known himself as the Lion of Panjshir. And he's also got like he's maintained a network of spies within the Soviet ranks, which are made up of primarily, they're not impressed, but as in they haven't been like four, maybe some of them, I actually don't know. They're ethnically or nationally Afghani, or maybe they're like Pashtun or whatever, the Middle Eastern broadly speaking.
Yeah.
But they're like serving in the Soviet army, but they believe in Massoud's cause. And Massoud is like, some of them are just willing to defect straight up. And they're like, yo, I'll just be one of your guerrilla warriors. And he's like, you know what? I actually am good on guerrilla. I've got plenty of applicants for guerrilla warriors. You know what I need? I need spies. And so he has a fairly large network of them. But it goes both ways. Like the Soviets also have their spies in Massoud's camp and so on and so on. He's like a very good tactician. One of the strategies, the guerrilla warfare tactics that he did that stood out to me is because he understood the valleys and the ravines so well, is that if there was a column of tanks moving through a valley in single file, he would have his warriors, his commandos, basically take out the first tank and take out the last tank. And so now this entire column of tanks is just stuck in this ravine, this valley, and they can't stay, but they literally cannot leave inside of those tanks. And so you just wait them out and pick them off. And then more than that, once the tanks are evacuated, you get your engineers in there, and now you've got Soviet tanks. You flip them, you know?
Isn't that, that's the old tried true one.
Yeah,
that's
man.
The tried and true. Yeah, that whole, you pick the first guy off and then the next guy, and then the last guy.
And everybody in the middle is sitting ducks, you know?
Yeah. Oh, man. Valleys. And have you ever seen a valley in Afghanistan? You seen their valleys?
I haven't.
They are very, very steep. It's a very...
I believe it. The image I get is very...
Yeah, very... Yeah. It is a very mountainous place, and those valleys are very steep. It is... Yeah, I watched the Korngal Valley. You ever heard of that in Afghanistan? Okay, that's a U.S. place that's had a lot of like battles and stuff.
Oh, okay.
Okay, all right. Right on. Somebody needs to watch Restrepo. That's fine.
There's loads of things that I need to watch. I'm so tired of TV. But anyway,
okay.
Spring of 1983, Massoud's tactics and his warfare generally proved so successful that there is a truce between the Soviet army because they need to reopen the Salang Highway. They need to get supplies to Kabul. This is ridiculous. There's a truce between the USSR and Massoud's forces, and it kind of shocks Afghanistan broadly, because they had adopted Massoud as basically as their resistance hero. You know, he's been he's been lionized, literally. He's the Lion of Panjshir, right? Mm-hmm. And so as a result, Hekmatyar kind of not usurps, but he fills the role that Massoud was playing, and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, Pakistan's main ally, becomes the primary resistance leader at this time, whose efforts are, of course, encouraged by both the ISI and the CIA.
Okay.
January of 1984, the CIA director William Casey briefs President Reagan on the war. He says that 17,000 Soviet troops have been killed. They've lost about 350 to 400 pieces, units of aircraft, 2,750 tanks and armored cars have also been lost, and around 8,000 Soviet transport vehicles. So they're making progress, so to speak.
Yeah.
April of 1984, Massoud.
What a sick thing to like to like have a meeting about. Like, I mean, I know you have to have that meeting if you're doing war.
Yeah.
But like, just thinking about like how sick of a thing to be like, yeah, man, we've helped kill 17,000 people.
Yep.
Like children, like it's, young people.
It's been it's a success. Oh, they don't talk about the refugees. I'm sure yeah, those figures were unmentioned, but they're like we've killed combatants, and it's like, but how many?
Destroyed so many people in their lives. And like, I mean, everybody does has these meetings, but they take a step back and how absurd it is.
Yeah. April of 1984, the USSR turns on Massoud and violates the, I don't know if it was a ceasefire, the truce. Massoud has the Panjshir Valley evacuated after learning of a plan to assault the valley with 200,000 troops from the USSR.
Wow.
After a carpet bombing. So they were going to carpet bomb the valley and then send 20,000 troops into the area to flush Massoud out, because he's really a pain in their ass, right?
You might not know the answer to this, but like are the Russian troops, who are they being led by, and are the guys they're being led by, are they like World War II guys? Because I would be scared to be led by Russian World War II guys.
I would say no, just because it's like 40 years later. If there was like a 20-year-old.
Yeah,
if he was like, I was at Stalingrad, you know, I was at Stalingrad, you know, drunk 4 days, right? You know,
and he
and he like rose through the command to become a Russian leader in the Cold War theater, you know, maybe
hard ass tactics
mm-hmm.
that they'd just be like, you can just a lot of you just need to die for this to work.
We're just gonna throw bodies at
this, yeah, which is kind of what they did,
yeah, attrition, man. It was the name of the game since like World War One, you know, and it was kind of cool the way Steve Cole described it, because Ahmed Shah Massoud like leads this flight of, he listed 40,000, I think, just of his fighters, and then he also has like civilians with him, and he like leads all of these people out of the valley like Moses almost. And just make sure that they don't all get bombed to shit and killed by the Russians. And so they, you know, they evacuate the valley, and he continues his assault from the caves. And there are these Soviet special forces known as Spetsnaz hunting them down. And these are some of the guys that he's fighting are just these elite I assume KGB. I don't know what the relationship is between the Spetsnaz and the KGB. I'm sure there's some overlap, but
Spetsnaz is just Navy SEALs. And this is like when the people, I don't know if anybody used to watch Spike TV. They always do like these, the Rangers versus the goddamn British First Commandos.
Yeah. And then Pirates versus Samurai.
Then one they always did was Navy SEALs versus the Spetsnaz. They're like, Spetsnaz, I think, they still wear like the kind of like the striped uniform that like a lot of Russians wear, where it's like striped. That might just be a Russian thing. I don't know.
I don't know.
The striped shirt underneath. You know what? Never mind.
Okay. So France and Great Britain, the way Steve Cole tells it, they start making contact with Massoud because this is an impressive guy, right? And the U.S. basically says like, France and Great Britain are interested in this guy. We also better be interested in this guy, because whatever Great Britain and France are doing, we have to make sure that we're also doing what Great Britain, you know, there's the fucking triumvirate, the global triumvirate, you know?
Oh, no, yeah, they're trying to fucking, they're trying to, you know, it's like at a company, whenever somebody sees somebody who's a good prospect that's going to like rise to the ranks, all like the like little middle managers try to like be like, all right, I'm kind of with this dude because if he rises, I can fucking catch on to that and fucking, that's what it is. It's that corporate mentality.
Yeah, man.
Just shining through.
We all, and then, you know, he's now Massoud's got options, right? And he's starting, he's sending out his dignitaries almost, his emissaries out, his guys, he's sending them out to the West and he's asking for, you know, rations and vitamins, x-ray machines for doctors and night vision goggles, radios and anti-aircraft rocket launchers. And he's got some options, you know, he's shopping around. He's got some people who are interested and he's seeing what he can get, right? October of 1984, U.S. allocations from the excess Pentagon budget are buttoned to the CIA or CIA's rise. So they're given more money. The CIA is given more money to wage this war. And it's matched by Saudi Arabia. They float about $500 million into the region. And there now arises the problem of keeping the war covert when you're dealing with this large of a sum of money and all the equipment that it can buy, and you're going to have somebody transport that equipment, and they're going to have to cross international waters, and how is this not going to get seen by whatever local press and eventually get leaked back to us, and all this stuff. And then more than that, you've got more and more U.S. politicians start touring the area. You mentioned him earlier, perhaps most notably Texas Democrat Charlie Wilson, of which the movie Charlie Wilson's War is based off of, and the public starts taking note. They're like, oh, the U.S. is doing something in Afghanistan. Oh, okay, right?
Let me tell you something, man. What are they going to get with, what, the $500 million that they match, what, $1 billion? What are they going to get?
I think that's total.
That's total?
They're gonna get like three, 250 and 250 between Saudi Arabia and the U.S., I think.
They're going to get the $500 million? Oh, they're going to get two F-35s? Come on, dog.
Basically.
They're going to get two planes. That's what we get nowadays.
Hey, I don't know if this is adjusted for inflation. And, you know, might be thinking, it's only 36 years. How bad could it be? You know, let me tell you.
No, it's the way that how much F-35s cost and how little we use that plane is so funny. Because it's just most of those, like, the fucking, like, war shit we produce. It's just so like some shitty town in Ohio can like stay afloat.
Doesn't completely go under.
Yeah, basically. Like that's what it's for. Like, we got to produce these F-35s. You know, everybody gets their kickback down the line, but then fucking.
Or else there will be riots in Akron, okay?
Yeah, but there's a fucking congressman from Ohio who's really concerned about it because his district is just going to go under.
Yeah.
They don't have the F-35. These people won't be able to afford lower middle class incomes.
I know these people, and you know, I know these men. I assume what just popped in my head was
fired,
like
we've already let go of half of the plant.
And they regularly throw bricks through my window and leave flaming piles of shit on my doorstep. And it's bad, man. I don't like, and I can't go to my favorite barbecue restaurant anymore because it's just full of union guys who just grimace and spit in my food, you know.
And that's why that congressman is so in favor of killing children in Afghanistan.
Yeah. Because he can't take the heat, all right?
Because his whole town's economy is based on killing children in Afghanistan.
Like, yeah, it's bad.
Yeah.
The same year, the CIA commissions, I didn't know this, they commission an Uzbek exile living in Germany to translate the Quran into the Uzbek language, and then they take those recently translated Qurans and start distributing them through Central Asia in order to turn the people in Central Asia. So now you're kind of Central Asia, it's right above Afghanistan, and so now you're almost widening the war, or you're turning the people of, you're hoping to turn the people of Central Asia against the Soviets and sort of broaden it in this weird way that you wouldn't expect the US to do, you know? Another tactic, I don't know if this was exclusive to that year, but it was just something regional and I thought was interesting that I wanted to bring up. The Spetsnaz forces one of their subversion tactics was to dress in the traditional garb of the region, like sometimes in burqas, I believe, even in order to pose as civilians. And so you'd just be seeing somebody completely covered head to toe, and you just assume one thing, and it's just like, no, this is just a short Russian Marine.
Spetsnaz, fucking special force. It's just like how they do now, and what they used to do now that we're out of Afghanistan. Like the SEALs, once you get like above, like I think Ranger level, baby, you're not in no plane. I'm not in a uniform.
Mm-mm.
I got a beard on. I just got a cap. I'm just wandering around. I'm just a common dude. I have to grow the beard so that the elders will respect me.
Exactly.
Like some of those people, there's with that unit, that like Navy SEAL unit that rode horses, like through Afghanistan. Like that was like their thing. Hmm. They rode horses, like kind of like the tribal people, the tribal region. And like wore the clothes. Yeah, man.
That's cool. I mean, that's like, it's not cool why they're there, but it's cool that's.
No, the army is very cool, dog. That's what it was like to be like little boys. It is very cool to do the army stuff. Yeah. But at the end of the
day. But then you have to look deep, you scratch the surface and see what am I doing all this for.
Yeah.
Like, oh, shit. Okay.
A lot of dead civilians. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. And there are people, and it's like just like a lot of death and horror. So, yeah.
March of 1985, Reagan signs the National Security Decision Directive 166, which is a blueprint for the CIA's upping of support for the Mujahideen, and it basically busts the funding wide open. Like money, weapons, equipment, and supplies are no longer going to be funneled exclusively through the ISI, and Pakistan starts making wider contacts in the war, and the US also starts cultivating their own network, and they start providing like plastic, time-delayed explosives, and sniper rifles, I believe to Massoud directly. This is kind of like one of the earlier instances where the U.S. is like, hey, Massoud is more or less naturally our guy.
It's always kind of portrayed that, like, the U.S., like, involvement in, like, in Afghanistan is, like, some get-back for Russia or, like, communist involvement in Vietnam.
Yeah.
But, like, I bought that when I was younger, but now that I've read more, I realized, no, you guys are just doing this shit in every fucking little country that has any type of thing. Yeah. So, no, it's not a fucking get back. You did it before. You're going to do it after.
I mean, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. It's, like, just war, you know?
Yeah.
Spring of 1986, the Soviets are basically looking for a way out. War's been going 7 years. It's been really messy, really horrible. Barbara Karmal is sacked as general secretary of the PDPA, and he's replaced, or nominally, like the new leader of Afghanistan is former secret police chief Mohammad Najibullah.
Let me tell you something. It's never good when the secret police chief is the fucking president.
No, usually that's not a sign that things are going great. It's not good, you know?
I've only seen this motherfucker peeking from behind curtains. That's the only time
I've never seen this dude without binoculars. You understand? Yeah. I can't trust a man who's always looking through binoculars, okay? Why is that dude so snoopy?
This man lives in parking garages.
I know.
Just walking floor to floor having meetings.
Just popping from a Camry to a Nissan to a Honda CRV, just talking to, I don't know who he's talking, I don't know why.
I don't know.
And then he comes out and he's still wearing the binoculars. You know, he never took them off while he was in the car, you know.
He's just getting favor grocery delivery to one of the stops down the parking garage. We're done.
August and September of 1986, these advanced heat-seeking Stinger missile launchers are given to the Mujahideen and other jihadists, and they're very effective at taking down Soviet helicopters. And there's just a bunch of these bad boys floating around to this day. I would bet that there's still just Stingers. It's hard to keep track of all these things. Like, basically, it's really...
Let me tell you something.
Because you're basically just handing over the Stinger, and you're like, hey, you're going to keep it. This is yours. You understand? You can't... Don't sell this. Don't give it to anybody. Don't give it to your buddy. You just keep... This is yours. This stays in your hands, okay?
Let me, Let me tell you, there's only one person that throws more money away needlessly than James Harden at strippers.
Who's that?
That is the U.S. government.
It's the American government.
Money away at a rebel leader who like has mildly endorsed just a general idea of freedom.
And I hate to get on the soapbox for a second, but you always hear like, how are we going to pay for this social program? And it's like, how about we just don't fucking drop truck cratefuls of missile launchers in developing nations. There's a way we could trim some fat from this budget, man. But then you're gonna piss off that one senator from Ohio. There's a coalition of senators from maybe not Ohio, but from various Ohios throughout the nation. Right. Anyway.
There are various towns where their economy is dependent on killing these kids. Though.
Yeah, man. One. Sandy. Of the other names associated with CIA guys is Gary Schroen, and he's in Afghanistan. He was associated with the Stinger program. November 13th of 1986, Gorbachev meets
I'm sorry, I have to do this. I don't know, have you seen the Rambo? You've seen Rambo. You ever seen the first Rambo? All right, you see the first Rambo, you see the second one, but the third one is the most amazing thing. Now Rambo has signed on for another contract, and he's in Afghanistan.
Oh, really?
And
whoa!
And one of these helicopter attacks were very fucked up for the Afghani people because they were just coming in just spraying because they didn't give a fuck.
Yep.
And so Rambo survives one of these. I think he takes down one of the helicopters also. Machine gun.
Does he like jump inside of it from?
There's
from
a lot the of jumping. I think he does that at one point. Get on the little on the thing and hang from it. Drop down, spray some Soviets.
Like, you know, just kind of bends over and like shits a grenade at it, like really fast. You know,
I don't know,
just
man.
Bends
he did
over,
a lot,
kind of squats and over, and then just like you just see him kind of shit this grenade at a super fast speed that it hits this helicopter and blows. That's what I imagine these movies. I hope there's this scene. I hope it exists.
He did a lot. He did a lot. Is so much, and his shirt was like off for like.
But no grenade shit.
63% of it. Okay. I don't think he shat a grenade out.
All right, man.
I cannot say that happened.
Then I'm not watching.
In a fucking.
Okay, then let me know when that happens, and then I'll watch Rambo 3. Okay.
I cannot say in Rambo 3.
Okay.
That's the best of the long.
That's a missed opportunity, if you ask me. Okay.
Okay.
This is why I need to get in there. This is why I need to get my foot in the door. All right, somebody's got to change the game in there. All right,
so many ideas.
They just pour out of me.
We don't want them. We don't want them out. We just wish they would stay locked up.
It's like diarrhea. All right, I have diarrhea of ideas. Is just I can't help it.
We didn't want that. Lock him up.
My mind's got the runs. Okay.
Lock him up.
Okay, I'm done. November 13th of 1986, Gorbachev meets with the Politburo's inner circle, Marshal Sergei Akromeyev, who's the Soviet Armed Forces Chief of Staff, says that the 40th Army had deployed about 50,000 troops in Afghanistan, but had been unable to close the channels through which arms were being smuggled, which... sort of fortunately, because that would be Pakistan. That would be like, okay, we're not only in Afghanistan now, we're also in Pakistan because that's the channel for arms, you know?
Yeah, as the U.S. government knows, it's very hard to shore up that border.
Yeah.
Because that's what we basically almost have been doing.
For
20 years.
Yeah.
It's trying to like have a control of that border.
Yeah. And Gorbachev, he takes note during this meeting that the Soviet public opinion is turning against the war, and so he's pushing for closure. So in May of 1987, Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze is talking with Gorbachev. He briefs the Politburo about Najibullah's plan for quote-unquote national reconciliation in Afghanistan, and Gorbachev is skeptical. He basically asks, like, how can you have national reconciliation if you don't have a nation? Like, Islam is central to the national identity of Afghanistan and will have to play a role in government. If Najibullah is not open to that, which I think he'd like signaled that he was open to some kind of coalition, but you know, anybody can say anything, right?
Yeah, I mean, it would have to be some form, especially when you have it like happening right next door in like in Iran.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I don't know much about the government of Pakistan, but it seems it was, I don't know. I'm not going to speak on that. But yeah, no.
I think they're fairly secular, but Islam still plays a large social role.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that lady did.
I think.
Did she get, he was on house arrest. All right, this whole thing. I don't want to talk about the history of Pakistan because I know a little, but I don't know enough to more than two words.
Yeah, okay, like, right on. So in September of 1987, Shevardnadze, the Soviet foreign minister, is in D.C. He's talking to Secretary of State George Shultz, lets him know that the Soviets plan on leaving Afghanistan about 5 months to a year. And the reason he's being so forward is because he's basically asking Shultz if the U.S. would work with the USSR to contain Islamic fundamentalism. Because as the war de-escalates, we're going to, you know, somebody's going to need to prop up someone more amenable, so hopefully, in each of their eyes, to some form of secularism, someone not necessarily motivated by jihad, and on the one hand, the eradication of the atheistic USSR, or on the other hand, the decadent Christian West, right?
Yeah.
There's a common interest here between the USSR and the US, more or less.
But here's the thing, that they're like the US and the USSR, like we should make this not go that way. They've killed, each of them has killed all the people or exiled them.
Yeah. Why do you think
these countries be those guys on either side of the spectrum?
Mm-hmm. You're not exactly have positioned yourself as the an ally here. You're not. Yeah. who are you going to try to dictate terms now? And it's like, no, we don't. We don't like you. You guys have been killing us for years. Like, why? We don't want to listen to you. You know.
Yeah. No. That guy's dad was reasonable, but then you killed his father.
Uh huh.
And he like saw his father split in half.
Yeah. And no, he doesn't want to. He doesn't want to. He doesn't want to hear your conjecture about what the shape of the nation should be. Okay.
Yeah, he's not reasonable.
The USSR was worried about the spread of like a more militant form of Islam to Central Asia. Their soft underbelly, which is kind of comparable. We were just doing FDR World War II. It's comparable to like North Africa during World War II, just geographically speaking.
Wouldn't the soft underbelly Italy?
Well, yeah, them too. But before you get to Italy, you got to get to North Africa.
All right. Go ahead. Sorry.
December 4th of 1987, in Washington, D.C., the DCI of the CIA, Robert Gates, sits down with his Soviet counterpart, Vladimir Kryuchkov. They're talking about what is to be done in Afghanistan, basically who would rule after a mutual withdrawal. And honestly, if you think about it geopolitically, Pakistan is arguably in the best position to shape the regime of Afghanistan, with Gulbuddin Hekmatyar being a favorite. And Pakistan telling the U.S. that they want someone in power, basically, you know, just like the U.S. does, only favorable to Pakistan's interest, and who would moreover protect the western border of Pakistan, the one they share with Afghanistan.
It's like they're looking for a candidate on LinkedIn, and they're like, yo, you gotta be like, fuck Iran. You gotta have that vibe.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You gotta have that vibe, because this is, you know, but then also you gotta be friendly with Pakistan, have their back, but also be like partial, not what the fucking. With the Soviets.
Yeah. Not with the Soviets. Yeah. And also not with India.
And also,
but that should be kind of a given.
And anger towards India.
Yeah.
Well, could you fuck with Pakistan just off top, off cap?
Yeah.
You're not taking any flights to New Delhi, fam.
No. Spring of 1988, Edmund McWilliams is dispatched as special U.S. envoy to the Afghan rebels. He's going to help navigate and basically manipulate the political situation in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. Then April 14th of 1988, the Geneva Accords are ratified. These are the formal terms of the Soviet withdrawal. Their withdrawal officially begins in, I believe, May of 1988. In August, a few months after that begins, August 17th of 88, President Ul-Haq's plane goes down, and he and a bunch of other top Pakistani leaders are killed. And there's the big question of who done it and why. And as far as I know, I didn't look into it. Admittedly, I think this question is still open.
There's so many fucking assassinations.
Yep.
like outside of this country that have happened that just like all of a sudden whole cabinet wiped out. Conveniently, the next guy gets ready to rule. He's just ready. And conveniently, the alliance with
this one guy had to go on a business trip to you know, they had an issue with a plant. They had an issue at a plant that this guy owns in some other nation. So he had to conveniently be away investigating this disturbance at this plant, right? And on a routine inspection on this particular weekend. It's like, oh shit. Oh, that's when that plane blew up that I was supposed to be on, but I had to deal with this private matter. Well,
it's a real sicko world out there. If you just think about like MVS and Jamal Khashoggi, like, fam, he was just going to get his license to get married, basically.
Yeah.
And they were just like, that's the time we'll strike. Like, that's fucked up. Like, it's a lot. Sicko world out there. Stay safe.
Very folks. Sick. Very stay safe. Yeah. So the U.S. begins to more heavily back Pakistan, and they decide that national elections would be held, and hopefully someone they like will be elected, right? And who knows what they did to help that situation? I don't even know. Edmund McWilliams, he's surveying the situation, meeting with civilians and intellectuals and officials, whomever, and he gets the impression that Hekmatyar, again, backed by both the ISI and the Jamaat Islami, which is the Pakistani branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. So not only do you have this, I think, nominally secular government-run intelligence agency, but also like a political entity, and a political and religious entity, moreover, is both like, Hekmatyar.
The ISI is like heavily aligned with like Islamic kind of radical groups.
Okay.
Specifically, it's a whole thing with them. Like, that's how they will attack. I think it's like their proxy powers. Mm-hmm. So I would say it makes a lot of sense that, I don't know about the entire Pakistani government, because that's a different thing. But the ISI fucks with any type of like radical, like terrorist. Okay. They have deep history of that shit. You ever seen? No, go ahead. Sorry.
Okay. McWilliams, again, is basically, he gets the impression that Hekmatyar is the favorite. He had been consolidating power and ruthlessly crushing dissenters and angling to take out rivals. Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, not a good dude by any stretch of the imagination. It's kind of a fucked situation to speculate. Like, you know, because even Massoud had issues. Like, Massoud, he definitely comes across as like the more sympathetic character, but also there were men inside of his militia, inside of his forces, who were like engaging in heroin smuggling and the heroin trade. But I don't really know the whole history of that as well. And you could say like, well, who wasn't? And it's like,
People talk about, people who've been to Afghanistan will be like, they talk about just guarding, like just realizing like, oh, we're kind of protecting a poppy trade.
Big pharma.
Like now, not like a poppy trade. And there's like a, Iran has a massive heroin problem.
And I haven't heard this.
Yeah, Iran has like a massive heroin problem because the heroin being smuggled in from Afghanistan. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And
it's right there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So meanwhile, the U.S. starts increasing cash payments to Massoud. So you've got this, again, this split. Pakistan says Hekmatyar should rule the country, or should lead the country, should form a new government. And the U.S. is like, we like Massoud better.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's February 15th of 1989. General Boris V. Gromov of Russia crosses the Friendship Bridge back into Uzbekistan. He announces that there are no troops behind him. The USSR lost around 15,000 people with 30,000 casualties. Meanwhile, the people of Afghanistan lost between 1 to 2 million, mostly civilians. End result, final analysis for this episode. You've got at the end, you know, as soon as the Soviets withdraw and the situation, broad strokes, you've got all these madrasas, which are like training camps on the border between Afghanistan and Peshawar. A surplus. A surplus might be an understatement. A superfluity of weapons in the area. Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and the U.S. all have their designs on the country and their favorite clients. You've got well-trained engineers have flipped a bunch of Soviet equipment and like restored a bunch of Soviet equipment. Masoud and Hekmatyar are being positioned as rivals for power. This is also where Osama bin Laden gets his start, and we will talk about that a few weeks from now.
Yeah.
Najibullah, the secret police chief, the secular dude whom the Soviet Union was trying to prop up, basically their client, he's still in power. So the Soviets withdraw, but like Najibullah, their client, is still got control of the government. So the situation hasn't really been, they just kind of wash their hands of it and like, good luck, bro.
You know, and one thing about madrasas genuinely widely like just Islamic schools,
of course,
religious schools, but like a couple of the madrasas on the Afghanistan,
yeah,
Pakistan,
at this
Florida,
particular place in this particular time, they take on a different connotation than what it has been historically.
Yeah, there are some hot madrasas around. Let's put
that for that sure. And then it's also interesting to think about this of again, in the broad strokes, broadly speaking, in perhaps too large of generalities, but the war in Afghanistan was the repulsion of the Soviets in Afghanistan, let me be clear, is more of it's a formative experience for a lot of Middle Eastern men, and that this was almost seen like a holy crusade, that this was your duty to repel the Soviets from the homeland, you know, from a holy place of ours, and they won. You know, all of a sudden you've got the Mujahideen, the holy warriors, these divinely inspired warriors defeated one of the world's major mechanized powers.
Yeah.
And then as far as the resources are concerned, so it's like, well, we've already taken on an industrial Goliath and we won.
Yeah.
I wonder what other industrial giants could be felled by our might, you know?
Yeah, it's like the call went out that this was a jihad. This was jihad. So it was a holy war. So,
and it paid off. It worked.
It just attracted. Yeah, like because people are looking, you know, to like young men specifically looking to serve in a cause.
Yep.
They know a religious cause in societies where religion plays a more prominent part than maybe it plays here.
Yep.
In terms of people's lives. Then they roll up there, and now they've just been through a war, and they're coming back to these societies with like a bunch of training. Yeah. And connections to,
and maybe weapons and maybe money and
connect. Yeah. They're now connected to the what the secret intelligence agencies or intelligence services of Saudi Arabia and therefore the Gulf states. And then now they might have some contacts in the fucking Pakistani intelligence.
Yep.
And so all these people come back, and then they come back to governments and places that not exactly feeding the needs of the people in certain ways, and they go back everywhere. They go to Libya.
Yep.
And Gaddafi had a lot of shit.
Sudan. Egypt.
Egypt. Everywhere. They go everywhere.
Yep.
And you just, it's like that weird like spores. You put the spores in the wind. And now they're going to plant seeds, and you know. But that's how it goes. Yeah, that's what war does, man. It doesn't stop. It just keeps going. It's weird like that.
Yeah. And then as far as resources are concerned, I'm sorry we didn't get to talk about the rise of the Taliban in this episode, but we will talk about it in subsequent episodes. Briefly covering the resources, there's this province called Helmand, which touches the south of Afghanistan, but it's like a kind of a sliver through Helmand.
Yeah, like the Mayo is, I think it's Helmand province.
Helmand,
I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
Poppies. It's
the one where all the Marines were? Yeah.
Poppies. Poppies. And like the valleys in the northeast of Afghanistan, poppies bloom, I believe, in the spring. And then they are, of course, synthesized into not only heroin, but I believe like a lot of pain medication as well. Yeah. Like Oxycontin, I think. I'm not sure which particular. I'm sure like Percocet, I would wager that a lot of the U.S. produced opiates wouldn't be possible without these poppies.
I don't know.
And that's part of why there was so much interest in the region. But also, like we mentioned, it's also rich pipeline country.
It's the opiate thing is, it goes back to, I got the name of the guy. He's a professor at the U of H, Gerald Horn, who had like this thesis that like, well, it's not a thesis, but he just talks about how if stuff happens in the U.S., there's usually an international context that like is always, that is connected to it.
Yeah.
Because everything, we live in an international society. So like,
yeah
man, a lot of heroin's just getting out of Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And now it's fine. Now it's connected maybe to a fucking
epidemic.
To like heroin epidemic here. In, I mean, well, the opiate. Opiates are getting out. I don't know. But the opiate, that shit's about the fucking, do our fucking pharmaceutical companies use heroin, use poppies from them, from Afghanistan?
Why? I don't see why they wouldn't. I don't see what all the fuss would be about for the past 20 years if there wasn't a little.
I think there wasn't
some involvement. This is speculation. This is conjecture. Yes, yeah. But there's a larger story here, I'm sure.
I know it's various people have various things that they're like interested in Afghanistan, but I know that fucking people don't want to let China or Russia have a major foothold in that part. And it was seen as our foothold in Russia's kind of domain, which is that stands, because Russia now takes that over basically.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were also seeing like as the like kind of preventing China, even though China was kind of from like completing a lot of their aspirations in the region, mm-hmm. as far as Afghanistan. But China was buying contracts. I don't know about that. China was buying contracts. They got mining contracts there.
Mm. Yeah.
I know that the heroin thing in Iran is a big deal. And like, I don't. This might be. I just know like when we came into Afghanistan, this is one thing that Iran was like, yeah, we'll help you. In Afghanistan, we're mm-hmm. down to send troops, manpower, mm. whatever.
Because this sounds familiar. Yeah,
there's a lot of heroin that's coming from this place, and then the U.S. they like turned them down, and I'm pretty sure their heroin problem got worse.
Huh?
If not, I've never seen a report on that. A report on like what the connection is. I've seen that somebody say that there was a connection, but I just want to know. I'm just interested. Is it like the same thing that happened here with crack in America, where it's like, oh. Yeah, we didn't sell drugs, but we did not arrest the people
who sold drugs. Yeah.
And that's the best story. That we didn't sell drugs, but we didn't arrest them. Yeah. In fact, we had brunch with them and talked about their numbers a lot. Maybe transport, stepped in a few times, you know, stuff like that. All right.
Paid for their spaghetti at the restaurant, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, guys, that has been... a history of Russia's occupation of Afghanistan from 1979 to 1989, correct?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
10-year history. I gave it to you the best I could. Yeah. I hope I got my
shit
right.
You did great. You did amazing. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, guys. Thank you to Henry. Thank you for listening, guys. Guys, actually, what are we doing next week?
Next week, I believe we have Exxon.
Okay.
Is that correct?
It's just going to be...
That is correct.
It's going to be... A loose history of Exxon's just corporate history, their kind of creation, Standard Oil procedure, like how that kind of broke apart, and how many fucking companies are just Standard Oil babies is insane.
Yeah, man.
Loose history of that, and then some of their troubles. I actually read a Steve Cole book also about Exxon. Kind of going, ranging from the
Steve Cole's the man. I must say, Steve Cole really good. Does a very good job.
It is. He was everywhere you wanted to talk about.
Yep.
It's like everything I've ever wanted to. Yeah.
But and he gives it to you in such like a it is concise. It's as concise as it can be, and as clear as it can be, given how fucking much there is to learn.
I would say matter of fact.
Very straightforward. Very like here's what happened, and he's not lecturing. He's not like. And here's why this. He's just like, listen, this.
Yeah.
I was like, all right, man. I'm with you. All right. Anyway.
Guys, again, thank you for listening. You can find me. I'll be at Phil and Derek's 8 and 10:30 Friday and Saturday.
Right on.
I'll be there. See me at Sunday, 8th Wonder Comedy Showcase, 6 p.m. at the Secret Group. And I'll be fucking at the back of the bus on Thursday. See you there, guys. That's at 8 on Thursday. That's a Secret Group. Thank you guys for listening. We love you. We'll see you next time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. We'll see you next time. Peace.
Peace out.